The Baker Street Journal is a leading Sherlockian publication written by the readers for the readers. It contains both academic articles and light, fun reading for any sort of Sherlock Holmes enthusiast. If you are a fan of The Great Detective and the other works of Sir Arthur Conan Doyle, and you'd like to read new and exciting writings by Sherlockians, or even find information on how to get published in the journal, please visit their website, www.bakerstreetjournal.com.
Wessex Press, an imprint of Gazadine Books, is a premier publisher of books about Sherlock Holmes and his world. They are also our publishers for The One Fixed Point in a Changing Age, A New Generation on Sherlock Holmes. It was edited by several of the Baker Street Babes and contains a foreword by Laurie R. King, the author of the Mary Russell series. Another brilliant book published with Gazadine Books is Matthias Boström and Matt Laffey's Sherlock Holmes and Conan Doyle in the Newspapers. If you'd like to know more about Wessex Press, Gazadine Books, or our publication, please go to www.wessexpress.com.
They call us the irregulars, but baby, we're always on time. Baker Street babes always leave the rest of them behind. So in Scotland, they send you home, you feel like you're losing your mind. If this quotidian world has got you crying.
Welcome, lovely listeners. I'm here doing Live and Local. My name's Artie, and I'm here with Bonnie McBird. Hi, Bonnie.
Hi, Artie.
And we're having tea and shortbread, and we're here to talk about Unquiet Spirits. Do you want to tell us what Unquiet Spirits is?
Oh, sure. Unquiet Spirits is the second in my trilogy for HarperCollins, second Sherlock Holmes adventure. And it takes place in 1889, which is 1 year after the first one, which was Art in the Blood. Unquiet Spirits looks at kind of a bigger theme of, like, what happens if you don't deal with the ghosts of your past? and it's an adventure, and it takes place in, starts in London, goes to the south of France in the Riviera, and then to the Highlands of Scotland.
That is so exciting. I mean, I've read the book, and I kind of, personally, I always like when Holmes goes out of his comfort zone. Like, we like London because it's like a comfortable slipper almost, but when he goes out of his comfort zone, suddenly there's a whole, it's a whole different ball game. So maybe that's going to be my first question to you. How did you find writing that?
Yeah, I like to take him out of his comfort zones, definitely. I think of France, though, as kind of one of his comfort zones because he's, you know, his grandmother is the sister of the artist Vernet, so he speaks French fluently. So I feel like he maneuvers around France easier than most British men of his era. So he does go down to the south of France, and once again he kind of encounters one of his minor nemesis, who is Vidocq, this man who calls himself Vidocq, which is a fake name because there was, of course, a very real Eugène Vidocq, who was a very famous man who founded the Sûreté. And he claims to be a descendant of this man, but he's just full of it because man had no issue, so he isn't a descendant. So he encounters Vidocq down there. He goes down to the south of France because there is a very famous scientist working on the phylloxera epidemic. Phylloxera epidemic was a very real problem at the end of the 19th century. It had started as early as the 60s, but it had, by this time, it had decimated 75% of the French vineyards. So the wine production, brandy, cognac, any grape-based drinks were very much affected. So there was this man, and this is a very real man, called Pierre Viala. There's a character in the book based on him. This is a man who's very like Sherlock himself. And he, of course, was the one who found the solution and the cure for this really diabolical disease. It was actually a parasite, but they had gotten it wrong for a long time. So Holmes is called down there, actually sent down there by Mycroft, because this man has been getting death threats.
Right. Fun. Okay, so you've touched on a topic that I wanted to talk to you about as well, which is the research that you've done for the book. Because as I was reading it, I thought, oh, I'm really learning something here about wine and about whiskey making and about the history of the commerce of alcohol in the 19th century. So how did you decide to write about that, and what did you do to research that? Did you go to distilleries or do anything fun like that? Can you talk us through that?
Yeah, it was definitely a kind of a please don't throw me in the briar patch situation. I'm trying to remember exactly how it evolved. I had in mind initially the idea about the ghosts, and then the word the spirits, just, you know, I thought it'd be kind of fun if there was, you know, something to do with a whiskey distillery. And then when I began researching what was going on with whiskey at that time, it turned out to be a really vivid topic, full of extremely interesting and meaty goings on right at that very time. And the research actually inspired quite a bit of the story. So the initial research was reading, of course, and I discovered this thing about the phylloxera epidemic. And as I read more and more about it, I realized that the troubles in the French vineyards and with the wine industry made those spirits very costly.
Right.
And so that opened the door for the whiskey folks to come in and position their drink, because prior to the end of the 19th century, mm-hmm. whiskey was a drink that manly men drank out of flasks out while they were fishing and hunting. But, you know, people in society did not drink this. You drank it out of a flask. And it was self-whiskey, which is what we call single malt now.
Oh, yeah.
It was called self-whiskey back then. And it was very strong and pungent and not to the liking of London tastes at all. So what happened was the French problems, because wine and everything get very expensive and scarce. And so two very canny, actually more than two, but two in particular, Scots whiskey barons came into town. And they basically invented modern advertising. So these were amazing. These guys were amazing. So I'm thinking particularly of James Buchanan and Tommy Dewar. And they both had a lot of personal charisma and charm, particularly Tommy Dewar. He was could talk you into anything, apparently. And James Buchanan created himself as a persona. So he wore a red waistcoat and he rode around town with the big red wheels on his carriage and a matched pair. And he was like, you know, look at me. And basically, he and Tommy Dewar got whiskey into all of these restaurants and hotels and gentlemen's clubs and theaters, bars and stuff. They basically positioned mm-hmm. their drink. And one of the reasons they could do that was because they had invented blends. Blends extended their reach because, first of all, they were suited to the palate of Londoners, and also they could be consistently flavored over a, you know, right. big batch of it, so they could deliver consistency to a brand name. So several of these things were going on. So these two guys and a few others, but mainly these two, did some amazing things marketing-wise. So James Buchanan got his black and white as the whiskey of the House of Commons.
Very nice.
And Tommy Dewar, he invented this hilarious thing. He patented this. I have a picture of the patent drawing in my annotations, by the way. It's hard to believe. He took the wheels of a carriage and he engraved "Drink Dewar's whiskey" on the wheels, backwards on the wheels. So when it went through the mud in the London streets, everywhere it was printed "Drink Dewar's whiskey," like all over the London streets. And so he did
That is incredible. Sorry, I mean, this is a podcast, but if you could see my face right now, it's an amazed and amused and entertained face.
Yeah. It was just crazy, these guys. So, and the whiskey industry itself has a very colorful history and kind of a slightly crazy one. The different families up there, there were distilleries for, you know, a couple hundred years up there or more. And they went through periods of time being completely illegal. And then there were periods where there was a great deal of, competition and animosity, and people were, you know, sabotaging each other, et cetera. But eventually it sort of sorted itself out to be these major distilleries. And as I learned about, you know, the French situation, and it occurred to me that, like, what if this was more than synchronistic? What if somebody had sort of done some industrial sabotage?
Mm-hmm.
Because it was a very fortuitous moment for the Scotch whiskey makers.
Yeah.
And it's like, well, what if that had been... Now, in reality, there's no evidence to that.
Sure.
But it's something that could have been... It could have come up.
Mm-hmm.
It could be suspected at some point. So I haven't read about that, is what I'm saying. It sort of occurred to me as I was writing. But politicians, of course, will make their case for whatever serves them, as we all know.
As we know, yeah.
And so I decided that there would be a French politician who's just mentioned in passing here, a fictional person, who has decided the Scots are behind this. He's trying to nail it onto one of three families, and one of them is a family where the daughter-in-law has already approached Holmes for a case. So this... Like my first book, Art in the Blood, there's three cases kind of that can confound into one. I sort of like a triple helix construction. Because, I mean, Holmes is so smart, you can't just give him one simple case, you know what I mean? It would be done by page 30.
Yes.
Because he's so smart, he would figure it out. So it has to be more, to do a long form Holmes, I think, at least that's the thing I've set out to do, is to create a more complex blended case where he really can't solve one of them without solving the other, so it makes it a little bit more difficult.
Okay, and how is that to write? And I think it was Stephen Moffat, but it could be any pastiche writer as well, who said it's quite hard to write someone who's smarter than you.
Yeah, the quote from Stephen Moffat that makes me... laugh so much is the one where he said that really the deductions are the hard thing to do, because basically that's the same quote. I mean, yes, it is really hard to write someone smarter than you, but of course you have the advantage of you can go back and rewrite it and set it up. You know how we can all think of the smart thing to say after the fact.
Oh yes, the French have a word for that.
Yeah.
It's called l'esprit d'escalier.
Right. Oh yes, spirit of the stairs.
Yeah, you know, that's what you think of when you're at the bottom of the stairs.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. Well, definitely, I totally agree, the figuring out the deductions. But it's not only just the deductions that are the hard part. It's also, especially in this longer form, is to decide where to reveal what, so that the tension mounts and that you're not pulling a rabbit out of the hat, because that's not fair to the reader.
Mm.
The clues have to be there, but you want to stay ahead of the reader. And yet you want to make sure that their stuff is there, because otherwise they feel cheated.
Yeah.
So it's a tightrope.
Yeah.
And I have to say that that's, you know, one of the reasons why I do multiple drafts. Maybe there are people who just write a first draft and it's mostly there, but that's not me. I write many, many drafts to get to this. And I do like maps. I do actually story maps of like where... who knew what when, and I do timelines of like, I had a huge timeline in this one because he goes up to the Scottish Highlands after he goes to the south of France to deal with this the threat to the French scientist, and then that takes him up to the family in Scotland, and they live in this fantastic castle with a distillery on the grounds. And so I had this huge timeline of this family, because this family has a lot of history, and Scotland is of course full of ghosts.
Obviously.
They, you know, it is the most, they probably have more ghosts per person than any other country. They certainly, more Scots believe in ghosts, apparently, than in any other country. Holmes says at one point in this book, you know, you're always talking about your ghosts and your fairies. And Isla MacLaren says back to him, yes, but except we do have Maxwell, and we have a few rational thinkers. And she names a few. He's like, okay, yeah. But, nevertheless, you also have the ghosts. And, yeah, of course, who would be more, you know, a better example of that than Conan Doyle himself?
Yeah.
Writing the most rational man on the planet, and yet himself totally believing in ghosts.
Yes, yeah, in his later life.
But apparently, apparently early on, I didn't know this, I thought later life also.
Yeah.
But as I did some reading, I discovered that even when he was in Portsmouth as a very young man, he joined a society there. But the description of his level of belief in spiritualism and ghosts was he was much more agnostic as a young man.
Right.
In other words, he was like, I'm not saying there aren't or are any, but I would like to see proof. I'm curious, and I want to see some proof. But as his life went on, I think he got more, the desire to believe grew. And of course, he had deaths in the family. And as sure. you get older, you know, you're facing your own mortality. Many people change in this kind of thinking. So what, for whatever reason, his desire grew. Mm-hmm. And once you're supposedly looking at something scientifically and rationally, if your desire is strong enough, you get confirmation bias.
Yes.
And, you know, you're not really rational about it. So it's an interesting trajectory for this man who's clearly a brilliant. When I sat down to write this book, one of the things, you know, we all draw lines in the sand for yeah. our own, the way if we're going to write a pastiche, where are we going to cleave exactly to Conan Doyle and where are we going to allow some room
yeah.
or not, whatever. And so my goal was to cleave very closely, and certainly in terms of the timeline, like this takes place in late 1889,
yeah.
and so it would be right after the Hound of the Baskervilles.
Yeah.
According to, now every chronology isn't the same, so I had to pick one and go
yeah,
with it.
Yeah, sure.
I used the compilation one, but or the most accepted, but you know, you can argue about that, but it's kind of not down there in the really. But basically, it's so I try to slot my stories into a place where there isn't one in the canon, and I try to not contradict anything in the canon, but make it feel that it could fit in. In that way, I try to be as close to exact as possible. I try to imitate the voice and be really true to the characters, who are so vivid to me, and so I love them so much. It's just such a pleasure to be with them, really. So that part is fun. But as Stephen Moffat said, yes, it's a freaking nightmare to create the deductions and the figuring out part. But I did it. it just was hard. It was really hard.
Yeah, I mean, from my personal experience of reading the book, I think you did that quite successfully. So
well, thank you. That it's a must. I feel like you have to deliver on that promise. You can't. One of my pet peeves when I read other pastiches, and I haven't read any for a long time now, because once I started writing my own, I stopped reading others. But when I used to read them, one of my pet peeves is when they would recycle the deductions, like they would just use Conan Doyle's and they would just stick them in their story, and it's like, no, that's completely cheating, you can't do that. So I started not to do that. And the other thing is, I wanted, because when you write a long form, here's where I'm very much differing, because Conan Doyle wrote short stories and novellas.
Yeah.
The longest novella I think is around 44,000, and so Art in the Blood is around 65,000 or so, and this is like 100,000. It's a longer book.
Yeah, it's bigger on my
yeah,
shelf.
It is a bigger book. And so the minute you take something that is pristine and works really well as a short form, as his short stories do, because he's a genius at short story writing.
Very good at short stories, I mean, yes.
He's killer. So the minute you take that and then you go, well, I want to do that only long form, you're not doing that. You're doing something else.
Yeah.
And so, but how do you stay true to what that is and yet go, okay, but I'm doing a different form?
Mm-hmm.
And when you stretch it out and make it be long, I mean, it requires you to do some certain things so that it still feels the same.
Yeah.
Or still feels like it. But one of them is, I mentioned earlier, is that the plot has to be more complicated.
Yeah.
The case itself, because he's so smart, otherwise he's just going to figure it out really quickly. So there has to be things in the way, and usually a tangle. So in both books I did this kind of tangled more than one case together. And then the second thing that has to happen is you have to really make sure you maintain narrative drive. That's one of Conan Doyle's geniuses, is the page-turning quality of it. It's like, you just want to know what happens next.
And, yeah.
You know, in screenwriting, we call that narrative drive. So for longer form, you've got to, it's a different engine. You have to have a different kind of engine. And so that means, usually, you know, I noticed in your review, and you said this in the first review you did too, of Art in the Blood, Artie, you said something about people who would like the Robert Downey Jr.
Yeah.
films, because I think because there's action.
Yeah.
But I didn't purposely put in like extra action for cinematic reasons. I put it in because when you have something that long, you need that that extra push, and you also need it emotionally, not just with action, but you need it emotionally as well, because that's what a longer piece requires. It's like a set piece. Yeah.
Yeah.
So the structure requires that. But then the other thing is, the long form gives you an opportunity. It's also a trap, but it's an opportunity to do more character development.
Yes, and I was going to ask you about that because you do some very interesting things with Holmes's past. You were saying before that, you know, it's about dealing with the ghosts of your past in a lot of ways. So yeah, you've spoken about ghosts now at length. There's something very interesting that happens where Watson goes to investigate into Holmes's past. I like that you've got Camford as his alma mater, and everybody talks about that university like it's a real place that exists. That gave me great joy. But you do some other things as well, and you go sort of deeper into that. So can you talk a bit about that, how that idea came about, and yeah, how that kind of fits in with the rest of the book?
Yes. Well, I first had Isla McLaren walk onto the scene, and as a writer, I'm a pantser, which means I fly by the seat of my pants as opposed to pre-plot everything. That's a little bit of a misnomer, though, because I start pantsing and then I go out to plot and then I go back to pantsing and out to plot, and I kind of weave the two processes together. But okay. When Isla McLaren walked onto the page, I did not know who she was. I just noticed that he reacted really weirdly to her. It was like, okay, he can be rude to people, you know, at certain times. He is in the canon. Mm-hmm. He really is.
Oh, yeah.
People that complained about BBC Sherlock as his being too rude, it's like, no, he's rude. No,
he is that rude. He really is that rude. Yes, Watson is the nice one.
Not always, but he's inconsistent about that. But when he's rude, he's really rude.
Yeah.
So I thought, okay, he's really reacting to her really strangely. What is that about? And then, you know, it occurred to me, I don't want to say the idea because it would spoil for readers, but suddenly the idea of why he's rude came to me, and from that came a thread. And basically what I decided to do was, you know, we know that there's something up with Holmes. We know there's something up there.
Yes. Like,
because if you just look at every line about women in the canon spoken by Holmes, it's really inconsistent.
Yeah.
So he's generally polite and, you know, gentlemanly, courteous, and likes to help people who are in trouble of whatever age, sex, or whatever they are. And he can be very kind to women in distress and so forth. But there's something with him, you know, but he also has that funny thing in, I think it's in the second stain, about, you know, women, their minds can turn on a hairpin or something like that, whatever that line was. And, you know, and he just, it was joking. I didn't think he was putting down women. To me, what that was saying was, I don't understand women. Like, they just befuddle me at times. And, you know, I think I'm getting it, and all of a sudden, like, I don't know what they're doing and why. And then he has that other statement about the sweetest, was it a triple murderer or something?
The nicest woman that I've ever met, was a triple murderess or something like that.
So, in other words, they fly past his radar in some way. And Holmes doesn't like to not understand things. It's rare. And so he doesn't like it. Because he has an ego about his intellect. And so
Really?
Exactly. So, yeah, okay, so he doesn't... I don't think he likes things that he doesn't understand. He's not comfortable around them. But also, you know, you don't choose to be celibate for life for a casual reason. You choose that for a big reason. And I think there's something unhappy about him. There's something lonely about him. It's not necessarily what we think, though. It's like that choice may very well be a healthy choice for him.
Yeah.
And a good choice for him. And he doesn't go into it much. But there's something hurting. There's something that was hurting there, clearly, I think.
Okay.
I feel like he's a bit of a damaged bird. And that's one of the appeals of the character. I think that's why he speaks to so many of us.
Yeah.
Because most of us have some little area of pain like that. I mean, most human beings do. And I think particularly people that are drawn, as I am, to this work, I feel an empathy for this character. So I wanted to know more, but I didn't want to know everything. So I decided I would explore that, but not all the way. Do you know what I'm saying? Because I really feel like Holmes needs to retain some mystery.
Yeah.
Because that's who he is, and that's one of his essential... that's certainly something I love about the man. So, but I did think, okay, there's something there. He doesn't understand women. And I thought, I got suddenly this whole backstory of something that could have happened where he truly didn't understand something that happened and never could, it was never going to be solvable. It was not just that it was opaque to him, it was that he was prevented from solving it. And it, yet it would be something that was very meaningful to him and very painful. So this story, this backstory just kind of came whole cloth. And as I was doing the research, it's interesting, the research sometimes comes ahead of the story and sometimes the story, it comes after the story. In the first book, just as an example, I knew I needed Holmes to see something about the wife that her husband, the doctor, had missed. And that one was, he saw oranges on her windowsill and he realized that she that was a common thing for morning sickness, and they were very expensive up in the north of England, so yeah. She wouldn't have had those. So things like that, where I knew I found the orange, like I looked up like what for morning sickness, and then that was a kind of a, you look to find the thing and then the story follows it. But then that came another idea from that was, how does he know that about the morning sickness? But anyway, so Watson kind of thinks that. But anyway, so fun, these things are circular. So this notion of what happened to him in Under Quiet Spirits is with the woman is, suddenly I realized that what if there was a death that he couldn't, that he was prevented from solving?
Right.
What if there was a crime or a death that he was prevented from solving and it ate at him?
That would be, for someone like Sherlock Holmes, massively traumatic.
Yeah, it would be.
Yeah.
And so that, I thought that would be very interesting. So anyway, I don't want to say any more than that, but it evolved into that. And it explains some about him, but yet still leaves a little. Because the other thing is that we all see the Sherlock that we want.
Yeah.
And that's the lovely thing about the writing, I think. You know, some people see him as young and handsome. Some people see him as, you know, kind of old and aesthetic, and or they see him as a certain actor they bonded with as a kid, or and some people see him as gay, and some people don't. Some people see him as asexual. So it's, I feel like you can have him however you want him. You know, that the writing allows that, or the writing allows us to have our Sherlock Holmes, and yet it remains consistent with what he's written. And yeah. I love that about the character. So I feel like that's, in one way, I want to really cleave to what Conan Doyle does, which is leave that space.
Yeah.
And yet stay very consistent. But because it's a novel, again, I want to do some character development.
Yeah.
And it's interesting, there was a huge furor over the last season of BBC Sherlock. And people were horrified that they took the characters in a certain direction. My thought was, like, they needed character development in order to make long form work. That's one of the essential things, that once you take a mystery to long form, it can't just be plot. It's just not interesting enough. And it just doesn't fit the forms. That was inherent in the form that they chose. Interestingly enough, the show House went the opposite direction. You love House? Yeah, you too.
I have a lot of feelings about House.
So yeah, I love that show. I turned it on and 3 minutes into watching it, I said, "That's a Sherlock Holmes." It just moved, like, instantly. House, in the initial seasons, had fewer commercial breaks. And so it had more minutes of time on the air, and it had longer acts, and it had more character development.
Yeah.
As the series went on, they went from, I think, 3 breaks to 5. They went from 3 acts to 5. And when they went to more acts and had fewer minutes, and the character development just went away.
Yeah.
It's a known feature, like, especially if you work in entertainment where everything's minute by minute and things are very structured, which I've done for years, worked in filmed entertainment. So because of that, you know that. And to me, one of the gifts of writing a long-form Sherlock Holmes is that you get more character development. Conan Doyle hints at it all the way. I mean, it's in there. It's in the stories.
Yeah.
And all of us, to a person, no matter what our preferences are, troll the stories for the character bits. You know, it's like, you know, where's the 3 caradibs moment? You know, it's like we're all, you know, and the, you know, and the devil's foot moment, and the, you know, we want those, you know, those brief moments of love between the two men, and the caring, and the, you know, whatever, the danger and that kind of thing. We were looking for that.
Yeah.
So, you know, the novel, you really have to deliver that. Otherwise, it's just so plotty. So I really decided to do that, and as I did that, I go, I'm taking a huge risk here because people are so personal about their Sherlock Holmes. You know, this is my guy. He's this way, not that way. It was very satisfying to write this bit with mm-hmm. him in the backstory. So there's really two parts to the backstory. There's what he was like in, not university, but what we call high school. Americans would call high school.
Yeah, secondary school in the UK, yes.
Yeah, so his last year of secondary school before university, something dire happened that Watson discovered, and then later the follow-up to that. And I had to very carefully manage Watson discovering that, because he's not really he's curious. He is curious about Holmes. That's consistent with canon, but he has to not overstep.
Yeah, I don't know. I felt like, as I was reading it from my own personal standpoint, and I felt pretty much like it's the sort of thing where you kind of read through your fingers. You're like, I want to know, but I don't want to know. You know what I'm saying?
Good. Yeah.
Because it's, I don't know, Lindsay said this once, and I think it's so true, that one of the great gifts that Conan Doyle has given us about Sherlock Holmes is how much we don't know about him.
Totally, yeah.
Because we can all fill in the gaps however we choose.
We fill him in with ourselves, basically. That's what we do.
Yeah, that's, yeah. I don't know, I watch Hamlet a lot, and sometimes I think it's the same, because he's an empty character as well.
I agree.
You just project yourself into it.
Both of them are so classic.
Yeah.
And done over and over and over, and looked at again and again and again, and performed by different people, emphasizing different aspects. So it was very dangerous to fill in some of the holes. I was very careful not to fill in all of them. Yeah,
the readers of the book will see for themselves, I guess,
right.
And decide for themselves.
Yeah, yes. I just got a review on Publishers Weekly that I got a starred review, which is really nice, and the reviewer said that I took real risks with the characters that paid off. That he felt they paid off, and that people would really like them. And so far the Sherlockians who I know who have read it really have liked the backstory that's there.
That's good. That's good. Yeah, I did.
I'm so glad. I'm so glad. It means a huge deal to me when somebody who loves and knows the character really well likes it. I was terrified about that, honestly. But you have to write what you love. You have to, you know, the bottom line. If you try to write what you think people want or what you think the market wants or whatever, it comes out like just utter crap. You have to write what you love.
Mm-hmm.
And I, you know, in both cases, I wrote the book I wanted to read.
Yeah.
You know, which is a thrilling adventure with, you know, really good mystery where that you can't figure out till the end. This is what I want when I read these things. And I want to know more about the characters, but not everything. So that's basically what I want. So I tried to give myself, you know, cleave to the standards of something that I would like. And I'm pretty tough. So I don't like a lot of them.
Good.
But you know, it's also, some people ask me, like, isn't it like complete hubris to emulate this writer who's a genius? And yeah, it is. But if you're an artist, aiming to be as good as somebody who's a genius is a worthwhile goal. You know, it's worth my time to try to do something as good, or, you know, in the arena of, it will never be as good because he's a genius. But to try to aim in that direction, that's a worthwhile thing to do.
Okay, right. This got very deep very quickly. Let me try and ask a lighter question then. My recorder is actually standing on a book about whiskey distilleries, and there's like sort of bits and pieces of research all around. So, can you tell me a bit about sort of the sorts of things that you did, people you talked to, books that you read? Is there some thing that you got to do or a moment that stands out something really nice and fun or exciting that you got to do or that you found or saw during your research? I mean, you talked about the, you know, the advertising before, which is great. Do you have more stories like that?
Yes. I realized I needed to see some distilleries firsthand. And I met very early in my research, I met a man named Charles McLean, Charlie, who is the foremost Scottish whiskey expert in the world, according to the London Times.
Right.
He's written 13 books, or maybe it's 17, on the subject. One of them is right here. he's really super knowledgeable and a very nice man. And he looks like Arthur Conan Doyle. I have a picture of him. No, he does.
He has an epic moustache.
He has an epic moustache. And he has very similar eyes and hair color. And I have a picture of him and me in front of the Arthur Conan Doyle Center last week, which I'll post, and he really does rather like him. And he wears a monocle on a chain. Anyway, he's adorable, and he's a very, very nice man. And he knows his stuff. So he, you know, sent me to some places, and, you know, I went to a few distilleries. I went to Glenkinchie, right outside of Edinburgh. And then I went up, I actually location scout for my books, so same way you do for a movie. Because,
oh, right.
So I went up to, I decided to set this in the Highlands, and I was going to set this place relatively near Balmoral.
Mm-hmm.
So that's in Aberdeenshire. And so went up to Aberdeen, and then I was location scouting for a castle. I went to Royal Lochnagar Distillery. Then I was location scouting for castles in the area, and I wanted a castle that was, you know, built over several centuries, added on, like, you know, kind of a mess, jumble,
mm-hmm.
which many of them are. And I found one that was that, plus it had been remodeled inside in the Victorian era and left. So it was exactly what I wanted.
Wow.
So I found, that was Castle Fraser, and I went there. The ultimate one that I wrote was a bit fancier and bigger than that one, but it was based on that and had some really interesting features, including sort of a spy hall thing that they had there, and the ice house that they had there. I saw those things and it's like scene just, you know, it happened in front of me as I was looking at this stuff. So that was quite fun. And of course it's haunted. There was a princess murdered there, and they dragged her body down the stairs and stained the stairs, and they couldn't get the blood stains up, so they put wood over the stairs and the wood's still there, and, you know, these kinds of stories. So, you know, you get these tales. And But specifically, like, bits of equipment and things were there. Then I really didn't have enough experience with the distilleries themselves, and Charlie told me that there was a distillery on the island of Isla, spelled like Islay, Islay,
yeah.
But it's pronounced Isla, and that there is a distillery there called Brugh Ladig, which has the Victorian equipment extant and working, and they use it. So they're still using the Victoria, everything. So it's like, okay, I got to go there. So it took like a train, a ferry, and a plane. It was like, it was really hard to get to this place. And I finally got there. Little islands, like 9 distilleries on this one island. Lafroig, a lot of Lagavulin. I'm not sure I'm saying that one correctly. But anyway, they're known for their peaty whiskies, and there's the big peat fields are there. Anyway, I went to Brugh Ladig, and there are these giant copper, you know, dinosaurs. They look like Jules Verne equipment. It's just so crazy looking, these distilleries. The distilleries themselves were ripe with adventure because they had, you know, like these big hot copper things, the outsides of which are, you know, you can burn to the touch.
Mm-hmm.
And the stuff is being distilled through them. And they've got these big grinders. They've got these big vats of hot liquids, some of which give out fumes that will knock you out, some of which give fumes that drop to the floor. And if you stand below the grating that you're standing up, you go down below there, you just die because of the carbon monoxide. And these big raking, these threshing things. I mean, this really scary, big...
It sounds terrifying.
They're big coal. They're shoveling coal into these, you know, furnaces. And it's really quite active and dangerous and interesting and and full of history. And And the people who work at the distilleries all speak of them reverently, like there's magic there. And
okay.
So there's a whole kind of emotional and artistic quality to these distilleries that is very distinctive. And I thought that would be a lovely backdrop to to this kind of gothic case. And it is, I mean, the people that work there love it. You know, it's one of those things that nobody works casually at a distillery. They're impassioned about what they do, you know. And so the island of Islay, like, they're pretty much, except for tourism, there is no other industry. It's really just that, just all whiskey all the time.
Right.
And people, they were so nice. People were so nice. I stayed at a guest house run by a woman named Fiona Doyle, who thinks she might be related, actually, to
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. So it was just an adventure and very, very fun. And I got to taste lots of whiskeys and had some favorites and very nice.
Great. Anything that you recommend?
Oh, yeah. So just did a show at the Edinburgh Fringe. And my personal favorite whiskey, one of them is Glenmorangie, the Quinta Ruban, which is it's finished in a port cask. So it has a port finish. It's kind of a soft, warm, Swedish finish to it. It's really nice. And that's the one we served. We did a whiskey tasting during the presentations that we gave. Charlie and I give a hour-long show together. I did readings and talked about the research, and he talked about the whiskey business and how it changed at the end of the 19th century, and then we had a tasting. It was fun.
Very nice.
And so that we used Glenmorangie, they were kind enough to donate to us.
Right.
And that is my personal favorite. I also, I like various others, though. I like the Bruichladdich that I visited, and I like the Bonnehabhain, which is also an Islay. I like several of them quite a bit, so it's been very nice.
Great. Okay. Right, so yeah, that's me pretty much all out of questions, more or less.
All right, okay.
I don't know, one last one before we wrap up. Because we've talked about some of the bits that are difficult to write, you know, the deductions and working out the plot and all that. But is there one scene that you can talk about without giving too much away, or something about doing the book, one scene that maybe is your favorite, or that was really nice and fun to write?
Yes, one of my favorites is very early in the book. Isla McLaren walks into 221B, and they've just basically blown something up, and they're trying to cover it up, and she walks in and just, this her sparring with Holmes, I think, is one of my favorite scenes.
Okay.
And I just liked her, although I also thought she was a bit dangerous and probably duplicitous. And so she was interesting to me. So that, I think that's one of my favorite scenes. And maybe another is the her Watson and Holmes have a falling out.
Oh dear, trouble in paradise.
Yep.
Yeah.
It's interesting. Sometimes these scenes seem to, I mean, they write themselves. That's the only way I can say. It's like automatic writing or something. I don't know. It just feels very, like, I can see and hear them.
Okay.
And they're, you know, they're young. They're in their 30s in these stories. So I see and hear them very clearly.
Okay. Do you see or hear specific actors, or would you, like, if you were to cast your version, would you have actors in mind to cast them with?
No, because they're a bit of an amalgam, because I've liked a number of performers in mm-hmm. the roles, really a number of them. You know, the right age is Benedict and Martin, but I also love Jeremy Brett, and I also liked Jude Law, and I liked Robert Downey. I really liked quite a few of the performances, Robert Downey Jr. as well. So I don't really have a specific actor in mind. When I did the illustrations for the first book, I cast two of my friends, who I also directed in a few Sherlock plays in LA, and I kind of see them. But they're very vivid to me, these guys.
Excellent.
They're very, very vivid.
Good.
And so many actors have done just such fine work. I mean,
yeah.
I feel really lucky. I mean, in a recent few years back, there was a conference, and I got to see Eileen Norwood, and I thought he was great. I'd never seen him before.
Mm.
I thought he was wonderful, and then I saw the Gillette film, of course. You were there too, in
yes.
Paris.
Yes.
And that was a thrill. He was quite handsome, actually, even as an older man.
Yeah.
And he had this gravitas that was
quite... He had real presence.
He did.
Yeah.
He was like, you don't mess with Sherlock Holmes. You just don't mess with him. He had that about him, and I really liked that. And he also, of course, knew he looked good from the side.
Yeah.
He's a very handsome man. But yeah, and I like the Frederick Dorsteel illustrations very much.
Mm-hmm.
So I have, you know, a number of images that are very appealing to me about these characters.
Okay, very good. Okay, any last things that you want to say to our listeners about where they can find the book, where they can find your annotations and your work and all the rest of it?
Sure. So I did annotations to both books. Unquiet Spirits, the new one, is up online now on my website, which is www.macbird.com. And just my last name. And so the annotations to both books, Art in the Blood and Unquiet Spirits, are up there. Those annotations were inspired by Les Klinger, because I love his three-volume annotated poems.
Yes,
and
we all do.
They're fun. They make me laugh.
Oh, so hilarious, yes.
They are hilarious, and they're so interesting. I mean, and I found the research process, I feel so thrilled by having to do this. I mean, it's just a joy to be thrust into the library and just, you know, whatever. I did the British Library and the Wellcome Library again, and you know, just I love it. I mean, I could live in there. So these annotations are fun. I also had help from a wonderful writer named Leah Cummins Gwynn. I don't know if you know her. She writes the well-read Sherlockian.
Yes.
And she helped me with some research when I was under the gun for some final stuff. And I just had a great time. I just had a great time with it all. So I hope that people will look at the annotations, because it'll enhance the reading. But don't read ahead, because it can spoil it. So if you open that file as you're reading, it can be kind of fun.
Okay, very good. Bonnie, thank you so much for chatting with me.
Oh, thank you, Artie, for inviting me to. It's a pleasure.
Great. Yeah, there'll be links to all of the things that we've just said in the show notes. Thank you, dear listeners. This was Live and Local. We hope you enjoyed it. Take care, and hear you soon.
This quotidian world has got you crying. Won't you 2-1 in my